Well, good afternoon, and I would like to echo Chris's sentiments and thank you so much for being with us this afternoon. We're the second to last session of another wonderful APHA conference, and we just appreciate you all hanging in with us. I'm here today to talk about pharmacists and ways that you can partner with them to increase provision of preconception care for women in your community. And I have no disclosures. So I've centered the talk today around three main themes. I'm going to give you two whys and a how. So why do we need an interdisciplinary approach to preconception care? Why do I think pharmacists are especially well suited to make an impact in many public health priorities, including preconception care? And then also a how to give some specific ways that you can partner with pharmacists on this important topic. So with preconception care, what we're really talking about are interventions that are focused on the prevention and management of health issues that may pose a risk to mothers and infants. And we are especially focused in preconception care on health issues that require action before conception or very early in pregnancy for maximal impact. So the overall goal is to ensure that all women of childbearing potential are in the best health state possible in the case of an eventual pregnancy. And we also have a term that we call interconception care, which is the care provided to women between pregnancies. It's a subset of preconception care. So I'll be using preconception care to indicate both preconception and interconception care. Preconception care should be viewed as routine health care every woman, every time, not just a standalone clinical visit. And the components include risk screening, health promotions, and effective interventions. So I'm focusing today on the clinical content of preconception care. There's a good review article that I've linked here for you that summarizes all of the evidence for the many varied recommendations that can be part of preconception care. So everything from screening for intimate partner violence to oral health for women, many different factors have been looked at in regards to preconception care. But in 2006, the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention convened a select panel on preconception care, and they identified 14 interventions for which there was evidence based that these interventions do improve pregnancy outcomes for the mothers and babies, and also for which we have clinical practice guidelines available. And these four evidence-based interventions can be categorized into categories including counseling, maternal assessment, screening, and vaccinations. And I also want to note that active management of fertility or family planning is also considered to be part of preconception care. The challenge is that right now, many studies indicate that women are not routinely receiving these preconception care services. And I've highlighted just a few for you. So the first is a recent study that was published by researchers at the CDC. And they looked at PRAMS data in four states, including Ohio, which is the state in which I currently live. And they found that in these four states, it was estimated that only about 18.5% of women who were surveyed through PRAMS had received counseling on at least 5 of 11 healthy lifestyle behaviors and prevention strategies before pregnancy. And when you look at this data broken down by race and ethnicity, as well as age groups of these women who were surveyed, we don't see any significant differences. So it's low, and it's low for all populations. There was also a study that was actually published earlier in this year that looked at a representative sample of ambulatory care visits for women of childbearing potential and found that only 14% of them included either preconception or contraceptive services. And then other studies have been done. This one was done by the March of Dimes and the Gallup Foundation, or the Gallup Poll Organization, and they found that only about a third of women of childbearing potential who were surveyed indicated that a healthcare provider had talked to them about folic acid. And we saw significant differences here, especially based on age, with only 7% of our younger women saying a healthcare provider had ever talked to them about folic acid. So what we see, and I could give you statistics for all of the other, you know, clinical interventions that are part of preconception care that show that unfortunately women are not receiving these services as they should. And we have a number of Healthy People 2020 goals around improving maternal and infant outcomes that do focus on many of these elements of preconception care. So I think to close the gap, what we really do need is an interdisciplinary approach that includes maybe other types of healthcare professionals that we don't always think about including in our public health efforts. And of course, I'm here today to talk about pharmacists, but there's a lot of other health professionals that are probably not being tapped to their full potential to help close this gap with preconception care. And so the model that I think of, especially for pharmacists, is to integrate pharmacists more fully into clinical community linkages, where pharmacists can either provide services or can be able to refer patients to services that are being provided in other areas of the community. Now, why do I think pharmacists are an ideal partner for preconception care particularly? Well, you may not be aware that recently the profession of pharmacy has made the Doctor of Pharmacy the entry-level degree for all graduates. So as of 2006, all graduates from pharmacy programs do have a Doctor of Pharmacy degree. It takes 6 to 8 years after high school to complete this degree, and it's different. Previously, pharmacists could choose to complete either a bachelor's degree or a doctor of pharmacy. The difference of a doctor of pharmacy from the traditional bachelor's degree is that the PharmD has a much more extensive focus on clinical training and physical assessment, so the ability to interpret lab values, do physical assessments such as taking blood pressures. PharmD students also have a lot of experiential education. They experience what we call introductory pharmacy practice experiences throughout the first few years of their pharmacy curriculum, and then they typically spend the entire last year of their pharmacy curriculum performing advanced pharmacy practice experiences in a wide variety of different clinical settings. And today's pharmacist has really moved from being more product-oriented to truly being patient-oriented. So we have a much greater emphasis on patient-centered care and really maximizing pharmacotherapy for our patients to improve their overall quality of life. And we see today a number of our students continue to go on and further their education and training. There's residencies available that pharmacists can do. These are 1 to 2 year experiences where they strengthen further their clinical skills. There's fellowships available to strengthen research skills, and some do go on to graduate school. Our PharmD curriculums actually provide our students with a lot of public health content. So CAPE is the Center for the Advancement of Pharmacy Education, and CAPE sets the guidelines or is the visionary of where pharmacy education should go, and our accreditation standards are based on the CAPE guidelines. The CAPE guidelines, the most recent revision, had public health as one of 3 main outcomes of pharmacy education. Most recently, it was revised that there are 4 domains of pharmacy education, and 2 of the 4 are very closely related to population-based care and health and wellness. All students must graduate from an accredited program in order to sit for their pharmacy licensure, and so we pay close attention to our accreditation standards. And if you look at our accreditation standards, there are numerous competencies that are related to public health, not only in the didactic, but also in the experiential curriculum. So today's pharmacists are getting much more breadth of information around public health. Now, pharmacists are highly accessible and can make a great impact, but unfortunately, we've often been underutilized in many different public health initiatives. However, there is a growing role of the pharmacist and the impact that we actually can have in public health. And so one great example is the American Public Health Association. They have one of the most far-reaching and comprehensive statements about what pharmacists can do in the realm of public health. And the first statement was published actually in 1980, most recently revised in 2006. And they talk in this statement about the fact that we are very accessible healthcare professionals. About 93% of Americans live within 5 miles of a community pharmacy, and oftentimes patients are going into a pharmacy more frequently than they may be seeing their primary care provider. We also, in pharmacies, are expanding the primary and secondary prevention services that we offer to patients, whether that's health education, screening programs, point-of-care testing, and others. And actually, we've just recently formed a pharmacy SPIG within APHA, and we actually had our first business meeting last night. So it's really exciting to see these synergies grow. There's other organizations as well that endorse and support rules for pharmacists in public health. We have the U.S. Public Health Service. In a statement in 2011, came out and indicated that as public health professionals through interprofessional practice, pharmacists can directly affect health determinants. The CDC had a paper in 2012 that was titled Partnering with Pharmacists for Chronic Disease. And then actually NICHO has singled out pharmacy in regards to the fact that, again, this issue of accessibility. Oftentimes our pharmacies are actually located in neighborhoods that may be considered hard to reach or provide accessibility to maybe vulnerable populations to seek care. So I'm here to share the how. What are some ways that I think you could partner with pharmacists if you're interested in collaborating with them to improve the provision of preconception care? And we're going to talk about these. The first is reducing the number of unintended pregnancies, providing education or medication therapy management for women regarding the clinical content of preconception care. Pharmacists can provide vaccines per state law. We can be an excellent resource of information regarding medication use and drug toxicity before and during pregnancy. Pharmacists can be utilized to help advocate for preconception care and can be partners when you are conducting research projects. So the first I want to talk about is reducing the rate of unintended pregnancies. As we've discussed in our session, about half of all pregnancies are unplanned. But what's maybe not often recognized is that among those unintended pregnancies, about half occur among couples who are using some form of contraception in the month prior to conception. And some of the most common reasons why we see this high rate of unintended pregnancies among couples using contraception is inconsistent or improper use of the method or discontinuation because of side effects. Pharmacists can help with those issues as well as issues around educating patients on what they can do if they have a method failure, for example, if the condom breaks or, the need for backup birth control. So in this realm, there have been traditional, or what I call traditional rules for pharmacists in family planning. And these include, dispensing hormonal contraception products, helping patients select non-prescription products that fit for them with their lifestyle and their preferences, counseling and educating patients on not only the proper use of contraception, but also helping to raise awareness and put into context for patients the risks of using contraception versus some of the health risks that could occur upon pregnancy. So sometimes patients may be hesitant to use some of the more effective types of contraception because of a risk, for example, of a blood clot. And actually for many women using contraception, the risk of a blood clot is actually greater if the woman were to become pregnant than it is for them if they're using this product. So pharmacists can help with that risk-benefit ratio and explaining that to patients. And doing this all, of course, within the context of a patient's own preferences for the number and spacing of their children. What I really want to talk about are some of these emerging rules for pharmacists that I think are quite interesting. So you may be aware that California and Oregon were the first states in the nation to actually allow pharmacists to provide hormonal contraception without a prescription. So in these states, women are able to directly obtain hormonal contraceptives from a pharmacist without a prescription. And the only requirement for pharmacists in these states to be able to provide this service to patients is that they have to complete a one-hour continuing education program. So these are relatively recent developments. We don't know yet the impact on this for women in removing some of the barriers to receiving contraception, but I'm very excited to see what this may mean for patients. Regardless, in other states across the nation, you can work with pharmacists to try to promote either what's called behind-the-counter or over-the-counter access to these products. So behind-the-counter actually refers to a classification of drugs that does not currently exist in the United States, but these would be drugs that are available only after consultation with a pharmacist. As I mentioned, pharmacists are trained to take blood pressures, and there are data out there that indicate it is safe to initiate hormonal contraception in women after reviewing a clinical checklist, a questionnaire to rule out health risks and taking a blood pressure. So this is something that pharmacists could definitely do for women. And multiple groups, including the American College of Clinical Pharmacy, the American Academy of Family Physicians, the American Medical Association, and the American College of Obstetrics and Gynecology, all endorse this idea of moving contraception over the counter. And in fact, the FDA has been looking into this issue since 1993. The second is to work with pharmacists to use collaborative practice agreements to either initiate or continue prescriptions for contraception that is expiring. So collaborative practice agreements are able to be done in almost every state, and collaborative practice agreements involve a pharmacist, a prescriber, and a patient entering into an agreement that a pharmacist can manage the drug therapy for that patient. And this often is used successfully for many chronic disease states, where pharmacists can, after consultation with the patient, initiate a new drug therapy, change the dose, discontinue a medication, and again, it varies by state law, but they're able to do that in most cases autonomously, and then within 24 hours inform the physician or the prescriber that that change has been made. So some have advocated that we could use that model in regards to contraception, that, you know, it's been used for other types of diseases, but we could do this around the realm of contraception and other women's health issues. Emergency contraception, some forms are available already over the counter, but again, a certain number of states actually allow pharmacists to prescribe emergency contraception, including over the counter forms. And that's really important for patients who need reimbursement, because it's usually with that prescription that a third party payer will reimburse them for that product. There have been pilot studies that have looked at the feasibility and acceptability of pharmacists providing injectable contraception, DEPO, in community pharmacies. And again, these pilot studies were performed in California and North Carolina. They looked at first or subsequent injections of the contraception, and they found acceptability among patients and an appreciation that it was easier for the patients to get to the appointment because the pharmacy is open for longer hours than the clinics were, and it provided them flexibility for their appointments. Pharmacists can also provide information to dispel some of the misinformation that is out there regarding the longer-acting reversible contraceptives in regards to the actual risk of pelvic inflammatory disease or the actual risk of infertility, and can provide referrals to women who seek some of the most effective forms of contraception. It's not often documented in the literature, but there's lots of potential opportunities to partner with pharmacists as local health departments and family planning programs to increase access to contraceptives and promote their safe use. And then finally, there's been some innovative projects out there looking at things like social marketing materials. And for example, the Iowa Initiative Research Program, it was a four-arm program looking at getting the word out on contraception, and it included pharmacy, along with actually salons, social marketing in colleges, and radio edutainment. Another area that I want to talk about is medication therapy management. And this is basically a pharmacist providing patient-centered care and looking at a patient's medication therapy regimen. And it is actually distinct from medication dispensing. So there may or may not actually be a product involved that the pharmacist is reviewing and making sure the patient's on the appropriate drug therapy. And there's many elements of this medication therapy management process. And some of these, the personal medication record and the medication-related action plan, these are actually tools that patients take home with them to help remind them how to properly use their medication. So as part of MTM, we have what's known as a targeted medication review. This is when a pharmacist is focusing on one particular element of a drug use issue for a patient. And I could see that counseling on folic acid or looking at medications that could be harmful during the preconception period, as well as providing vaccines, could be done in this model. And we actually have a study launching in the next week or two in Ohio, a proof of concept study looking at Ohio Medicaid patients who are on managed Medicaid and the provision of TMRs by pharmacists to women in this population focusing on these three issues. So stay tuned. I hope we'll have some really good data around that. Another element of MTM is what's known as a comprehensive medication review. So this is sitting down and looking at all the meds the patient is on, and this is reserved for more chronic disease states or complicated patients. So diabetes is an excellent topic that pharmacists could sit down, partner with patients, as Annalisa mentioned. The hemoglobin A1C guidelines are more strict for pregnant women, and pharmacists could really work with women, especially maybe identifying meds on the $4 list or helping them obtain meds through patient assistance programs if they have difficulty affording their medications. Counseling and education is part of MTM, as well as screening, support, and referrals. And just briefly, I'll indicate, for example, there's been some really interesting pilot projects that have been done around the nation looking at point-of-care testing with rapid HIV testing in community pharmacies. So we're expanding more into this area as well. Vaccines. Pharmacists can have several important roles in regards to vaccines. We can educate patients about the need for vaccines. We can facilitate vaccines by, again, either referring patients or by stocking the drug product and making it available to those who administer the vaccines. But actually, in all 50 states, pharmacists are able to provide immunizations. Now, variation does exist by state in regards to the patient population, which a pharmacist may vaccinate, and which vaccines they may give. But for example, in Ohio, where I work, we can vaccinate patients age 7 or older, and any vaccine that is listed by the CDC ACIP. So MMR and hepatitis B and these vaccines that are part of preconception care, pharmacists may be able to provide for your patient. Drug information. Pharmacists and students are trained in medical literature retrieval and evaluation, and we can provide and interpret, again, this information on drug use during pregnancy, provide maybe information on alternatives that may pose less risk to mothers and the fetus. Now, if you don't necessarily have access to a pharmacist where you work, please know that there are drug information centers available across the nation. And for example, at my university, we have one that is completely free of charge. So if you do have a question, we service both professionals and patients. They can call and we can get their question answered. Advocacy, thinking about collaborating with pharmacists, especially to inform laws and regulations. You know, many times you may need background information or expert testimony on certain issues, and pharmacists may be uniquely able to provide some of that information for you. We also have strong professional associations, both nationally and at the state level, that could serve as partners for you in getting your word out or your message out. For example, the Ohio Pharmacists Association has been doing a lot around the issue of infant mortality in Ohio and raising awareness among its members. Finally, I just want to touch on research. It's often overlooked to think about collaborating with pharmacists in research projects. But I encourage you to do so, and of course you may think of those in academia as being natural partners, but just to raise awareness that pharmacists involved in practice also are performing research. So one example is the American College of Clinical Pharmacists. They have a women's health practice and research network. These are pharmacists across the nation who collaborate together on research projects impacting maternal health. And there's also pharmacy-based, practice-based research networks. These are out of AHRQ, and they bring together practitioners and researchers to collaborate on practice-related topics. So many of your community pharmacists may be involved in these. Traditionally, we've seen a lot of physicians' offices involved in these networks, but it's expanding to pharmacy as well. So in conclusion, I would like to leave you with two quotes that hopefully encapsulate what we've talked about today. The first is, please do think when you are planning and implementing and even needing to evaluate your programs to incorporate a pharmacist, because any effort to increase the use of preventative services and improve women's health status must be interprofessional in nature, and hopefully you will include pharmacy as one of those. And then finally, we have had documented success, especially in low-income countries, in regards to ways that pharmacists are directly impacting maternal and infant outcomes. So here in the U.S., when pharmacists are able to fully practice within their full scope of practice, hopefully we'll be able to make even more positive inroads as well. So thank you so much for your time and attention, and I'm happy to take any questions.
Myself or whatever. See, young people talk to their pharmacists about personal. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean?
Yes.
So will you comment a little bit about the practice level? First of all, I love it. I think it's a really, really important thing. But talk about the practical application.
Mm-hmm.
And my pharmacist is he's a wonderful man, but he's an elderly man. No, there's no young girl that's been talking about. You know what I mean?
I do know what you mean.
And there's pharmacy tags, and, you know, there's all sorts of promotion, and you can't have those intimate conversations like you would in the physician's office.
Mm-hmm.
We can talk about the practical application of all the wonderful ideas.
Yes, I definitely will. So especially in regards to counseling on contraception, which I agree, there are many barriers currently with how the physical layout of many pharmacies are set up that cause concern for patients not only to discuss contraception, but many of their other health needs or questions that they may have for a pharmacist. And so there are a lot of innovative programs actually happening right now from many of our national chain pharmacies to completely redesign actually what community pharmacies look like. And so I've actually seen some presentations of some models that they are actually starting to implement, and granted it will take a long time for this to be rolled out across the country with the thousands of pharmacies that we have, but really innovative models looking at private consultation rooms being in the pharmacy location and pharmacists actually being outside, not behind the counter, but in the store, able to much more readily interact with patients and then take them to the private consultation room as needed to discuss these health issues. So there are some small scale stores that I'm aware of, especially a lot of independent stores that have already taken this step to have these private consultation areas, but national chain drugstores are actually actively planning to try to make their pharmacies more of a place that these types of private conversations could be had. Yeah. Yes, I know. Yes, of course. Yes.
Well, just to piggyback on that, I'm just wondering that in between before they redesign,
mm-hmm.
there's a lot of CVS and places like that or Walgreens that have mini clinics or whatever mm-hmm. they're calling it. And there's a lot of times I'm in there that they're not actually giving shots or doing anything. So I wonder, and it's essentially a private room that's kind of off. I mean, it's usually right next. My place where we live in Indianapolis, a lot of them are right by the pharmacy.
Mm-hmm.
So it's literally like a couple of steps away. It would be no different than them seeing where you're getting consultation mm-hmm. at the counter. So I'm wondering there might be a way to make this a little more seamless. I mean, I do agree that maybe it would help in a general sense to redesign it, but if that takes a while, there's kind of other options. But sometimes it becomes an underutilized room. They're not giving shots to provide them clinic.
That's an excellent point. Definitely utilizing all the space that we have available. Yeah.
Hi, thank you for presenting this potentially a revolutionary concept. And I'm just thinking a comment would be that, the comment is that I just wonder if she needs shot or she spends more time at pharmacy than anywhere else. Every other face-to-face walk that you get,
mm-hmm. Yes, I mean, we do tend to see higher rates of unintended pregnancy being reported among younger women, you know, especially teenage women. So yes, and I mean, just for the interest of time, unfortunately, I couldn't give, you know, all examples that I had, but there's actually been a movement, I guess, for lack of a better word, to create what's known as youth-friendly pharmacies. And these would be places that younger, you know, individuals would feel comfortable talking to a pharmacist about these topics. It also goes hand in hand with a movement to unlock condoms in pharmacies, because many times, unfortunately right now, because of the high risk of theft, these products may be kept under lock and key, and it prevents people from asking for these products. And so I've seen studies focused on both youth-friendly as well as greater accessibility to the over-the-counter products, and some actually in combination. And some pharmacies around the issue of youth pharmacies, around also issues like emergency contraception, have created like what they call shelf talkers, you know, to encourage patients, like, you know, we help patients with XYZ issue here, or they can wear buttons, and there's been ways that pharmacists have tried on a kind of a non-invasive way just to let patients know that they provide these types of health services. And some pharmacies have even looked at issues like having written cards where patients, and especially younger patients, could just present this card to the pharmacist requesting, for example, emergency contraception, rather than even having to say it out loud if that would be a barrier or something they're potentially concerned with. So there's been a lot of pilots looking at it. Yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I'm from Washington State, and we have a lot of really great reproductive laws. But one of the barriers that we've been dealing with is pharmacists not dispensing
conscientious objection.
Yes.
Yeah. So that's a really great question. Conscientious objection refers to not only pharmacists, but, you know, other health professionals deciding, you know, for example, for a pharmacist not to dispense oral contraception or emergency contraception because they don't personally believe in it. The short answer is it's complicated. Every state has its own regulations as to whether or not a pharmacist can exercise that right. So some states explicitly protect the right of a pharmacist to do that. Some states explicitly say no, pharmacists cannot do that. In addition, there may be different policies where pharmacists work. So if you work for a particular chain drugstore, they may have their own policy on conscientious objection. So our national organization, the American Pharmacists Association, the guidance, although it's non-binding, is that pharmacists, if they're exercising conscientious objection, should only do so if they can ensure that patients would have provision for these services otherwise. But again, that's a non-binding guidance from our professional organization of how that should be handled. So I actually could share with you when we're done here a website that, you know, kind of lists state by state and what the legal requirements are, and you can kind of see all the variation out there around those laws.
And I guess there was, I think, something for you all to think of. And once again, I think this is so great, but I would be concerned that you have pharmacists sort of muted up with a crisis pregnancy center model of pharmacy, mm-hmm. where we go for a certain kind of education to a pharmacy that advertises itself as where you get this information, and then you find, well, maybe, you know, steer away.
Oh, so kind of like a bait and switch type thing,
yeah,
where they're, yeah.
Yeah,
yeah.
It wouldn't happen. I mean, so just something to be aware of. And then I was going to ask you about staffing.
Mm-hmm.
Because you know, we have, like, as a provider, I have 15 minutes to go to that prenatal care visit and go over all that stuff. I would love it if somebody else could take some of that off my plate, but how does that look? Those conversations aren't the way.
So, for example, the medication therapy management that I talked about, this is a service that actually pharmacists can get reimbursed to provide. And so that's always been a challenge for pharmacists, is getting reimbursed for cognitive services rather than dispensing the prescription. So now that we can start being reimbursed for cognitive services, I think we're going to see a lot more types of services that pharmacists are providing. You know, my idea is to take it into preconception care, but there's many other chronic disease states as well. But just like anything, it takes time to adapt, or, you know, these practices. So, for example, medication therapy management typically was paid for by Medicare Part D, so not many people Medicare Part D are going to be of childbearing potential. Well, an exciting development in Ohio is that, as I mentioned, our managed care Medicaid is now paying for MTM, and this opens it up now to a much younger patient population. So as different insurers and different providers, or not providers, but you know, like Medicare, Medicaid, others, start listing pharmacists and pharmacy services as things that they reimburse for, I think we'll see a lot more movement in this area. Okay. I believe both were just in 2015. I mean, they're both recent. No, not yet. You're exactly right. So there are definitely issues around staffing and time crunch for pharmacists. As a profession, we are moving away from being so product-oriented, but unfortunately that is the reality still for a lot of practicing community pharmacists. So two thoughts I have. One is, in the community pharmacy model, again, there's some innovative things being piloted, and again, I'm not sure what practicing pharmacists will think of this, but there are some innovative programs looking at things like off-site checking of the accuracy of dispensing of prescriptions, also iPads, you know, pharmacists being able to visually do things on an iPad so they could, again, they don't have to physically be in the back of the store. A lot of places, like in Florida, for example, I know that one large chain in Florida, they don't do refills at your pharmacy. You have to actually call in, and it's done at one of several central locations and then delivered to the pharmacy. So you need to at least call 24 hours in advance to get your refill. So, I mean, a lot of pharmacies are moving away from this kind of like distribution model where all the meds are being distributed at all the pharmacies all the time. Another thing I'd just like to highlight too is there are lots of pharmacists that work in a lot of areas that don't include retail pharmacies. So if we think of, you know, clinical pharmacists working in hospitals, and it's even becoming more common that pharmacists or even working in doctors or other primary care practices, you know, these could be models as well, especially under, for example, like the collaborative medication therapy agreement, that pharmacists could be providing this care. So it's not always the community pharmacist. You know, there's a lot of other types of pharmacists too that I envision could do this type of service. But yes, I mean, I agree. It's not necessarily, all of these elements are not necessarily realistic with where pharmacy is today. But I think by initiating this conversation, we can hopefully move it forward.
Any other questions for the other panelists? Well, let's give a round of applause for everyone.